Exodus chapter 14, we're going to look at the whole chapter today as we look at the crossing of the Red Sea. A lot of these stories, they just keep on, we're so familiar with them. And it's like an anthology where you get one story after another story after another story, and they all comprise one great big story, but each part of the story, each chapter of the story is almost better than the one before it. You get to find out, man, you know, the water to blood was great, but I love the frogs part, and then I love the lice part, and then the whole Passover part, that's really terrific. And now all of a sudden we have the crossing of the Red Sea, and it just, the story keeps getting better and better as it moves forward. Exodus chapter 14, we'll read through the passage, and we'll look at what the Lord has for us today. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamped in front of Pahahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, 'They're wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in.' And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord." And he uses his covenantal name, "I am Yahweh." And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. They said, "What is this that we have done, that we've let Israel go from serving us?" So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly with a high hand. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, encamped at the sea by Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal-Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. The people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, Is it because there are no graves in Egypt, that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." Moses said to the people, "Fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You have only to be silent." The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the hosts of Egypt and the host of Israel. There was the cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night, and made the sea dry land. The waters were divided, and the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, and all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." And the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. as the Egyptians fled into Egypt, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen of all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in His servant Moses. We come to this text. It's a thrilling story as you see it, as you watch it laid out. We've been looking at the past several times how God is doing a work. He's beginning a work, and in the work, He's bringing us on the adventure of a lifetime. And as the adventure begins, the obedience that's required in coming out and stepping out in faith isn't the end of the journey, it's the beginning of a journey. A journey that's going to, in fact, take an entire lifetime to see us through. And as you think about the, for lack of a better term, the adventure of a lifetime, okay, it actually follows along some fairly simple lines. We're going to see this morning that Moses is going to have a divine dilemma, and then Moses is going to have a divine deliverance. Those are the only two main points of the story. The first half of the story is the dilemma that he finds himself in. The second half of the story is the deliverance that God provides for him in the midst of his dilemma. I think it's important for us to get this in our heads because this is how God routinely works. God routinely brings us to the place where it looks like it's a divine dead end. Chuck Swindoll, in writing on this passage, calls it a cul-de-sac. And so as we look this morning, there's just these two aspects to this adventure. There's first a divine dilemma, this divine dead end that, and it has to be divine because God's in it. You ever find yourself in the place where you can't go forward because you're at the end of the cul-de-sac? You can't go far this way because the cul-de-sac is kind of a circle. You can't go that way because it borders you and you turn around. The only way out is the only way you got in. There's really no way to get out of this dead end circle. And as we come to this text, we see that they're in this cul-de-sac. They're at this dead end by God's leading. Look back at the last chapter, chapter 13, verse 21. The Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, by night in a pillar of fire to give them light that they might travel both by day and by night. This pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night did not depart from the people of Israel. God's going in front of them. And then verse 1 of chapter 14, God speaks to Moses and he tells him where to go. So he's leading them there. He's telling them where to go. And listen to what he tells them. He gives them the wrong direction. Tell the people of Israel to turn back. Whoa. Wait a minute. We just got out. You want us to, you heard me, turn back. He tells them in verse 2, tell the people to turn back and camp in front of Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Ziphon. You shall camp facing it by the sea. So on the north of this camping spot, there's Baal Ziphon. It's literally means God of the North. We don't know exactly if it was a religious center, but if it was, it would also be a military outpost. They would have a lot of people there. So as the people have come out, they're camping in front of this probably religious center / military outpost of Egypt. That's on their north. Obviously, off to their east, they've got the Red Sea. On the west, they've got the Red Sea. On the east, they've got Migdol. And just beyond that is Goshen, the land that they just came out of. On the south, there's a desert. There's no way for them to go. And as things start to happen, they're going to find that they're hemmed in. Several different writers have called this between the devil and the deep Red Sea. They're stuck. There's no place for them to go. But God told them to go a direction that by man's viewpoint is asinine. It's the wrong direction. Then he tells them to perform the wrong action. Look again at verse 2. Tell the people to turn back, to go the opposite direction, and then set up camp. Wait a minute, God. We're on the run. You want us to just like stop. Right now, you've put us in a very difficult place. You've put us in a place that doesn't seem advantageous to our welfare. And you want us to just stop here? You ever been at that place in life where you can count off the things to God? God, don't know if you noticed this, but this is wrong. This circumstance in my life doesn't line up the way I think it should. This one's backwards. This one's upside down. This one's just plumb irritating. And this one just doesn't make sense. Okay, God, I think it's time for me to move. And God says, no, I think it's time for you to camp. That's a tough one. God says, I've got you right where I want you, and I want you to slow down because I don't want you to miss anything. Okay? He's told he's going to have to deal with the wrong person. Verse 3. Here's why I want you to camp. He uses the word because. You shall camp there because Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they're wandering in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And he will pursue them. Whoa, 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 whoa. Wait a minute, God. I thought we were like done with this guy. No, you're not done with Pharaoh. Because I'm not done with Pharaoh. The wrong person, the wrong expectation. He will pursue you, Moses. He's going to pursue you. You're not done with him. He's still coming after you. Okay, so God, let me get this straight. You bring me to a dead end, and rather than moving farther away from the problem, you stop me so that the problem can come get me. Is that right? Am I understanding this properly? You've got it. You've got it. God, this looks like an ambush. And God says, you're absolutely right. Moses says, this looks like an ambush against me. And God says, no, this is an ambush against Pharaoh. What an amazing thing. God takes time to set up this dilemma. It has to be God, because even Moses wouldn't have done this, and Moses isn't the greatest of leaders at times. But even Moses wouldn't have put himself here, let alone 2 million people along with him. But God brings him to this place. It's divinely set up. And I love how the end of this section ends in verse 4. And they did so. They did so. I think it's important in the midst of all these things that God doesn't just leave him with the wrong direction, the wrong action, the wrong person, the wrong expectation. He gives him in verse 4 an explanation of why he's doing what he's doing. He says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, Pharaoh will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. Moses, I don't want you to disconnect this dilemma from my purposes. Okay? Is it a tough place? Yes. Does it seem foolish from your perspective? Yes. Okay? But I'm doing this on purpose, and my purpose is this. My glory must find manifestation. It's like spilling over. It's like blowing up a balloon and then giving it one more puff so that it pops. God says, I want my glory to overflow. I want it to burst out. I want people to see the kind of God that I am. My glory's at stake, Moses, in this dilemma that you find yourself in. And for Moses, it was enough. He says, okay, folks, set up camp. Right here? Right here. Right now? Right now. Wrong direction, wrong motion, wrong person, wrong expectation, and the only explanation he's given is, Moses, my glory's at stake in this one. I love how Psalm 23 states it. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness. How's it go? Okay. In the middle of my wanderings, behind my shepherd who leads me, is the welfare of the sheep important? Absolutely. Absolutely. But even more important than the welfare of the sheep is the glory of the shepherd. Does God care for you? Absolutely. But even more important than my welfare is the glory of my God. God says, you can bank on me. I'm not going to let you down because my whole reputation is at stake in my care of you. I'm not going to fail you because my whole reputation, my honor as God is at stake in you. And I want everyone, I want even my enemies, the Egyptians, to know what kind of God I am. You ever get uptight and wonder, man, I wonder if God really cares? The fact is, He does, okay? But life is pinching me in from every side. I'm in that Psalm 46. I'm in that trouble. I'm in that strait. It's pressing me in from every direction. But God is with me, seeing to my welfare, and He's also guarding His glory in the midst of this situation. As this dilemma is set up, we're going to have three different voices that enter into the story. Each of them are introduced by a question. So the first voice is the problem that we face. Verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people, and they said, what is this we have done? You can look a little bit further down, and verse 11, the people are going to ask Moses, what is this you have done? And in effect, later on, God is going to say in verse 15, what is it that you're doing? What have we done? What have you done? What are you doing? And all these different voices are introduced with a question. Say, hey, what's going on here? The first voice is the problem that we face. That is the Egyptians. They say, what have we done? We've gotten rid of Israel. We've let them go from serving us. So he made ready his chariot. He took up his army with him and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He pursued the people, while all the people of Israel going out defiantly, and the Egyptians pursued them. And he tells how much, what extent, all Pharaoh's horses, all his chariots, all his horsemen, all his army. He overtakes them. As this part of the passage unfolds, we get to listen. We get to listen to a voice, the voice of the problem. It's a problem that we face. It's a problem that we fear. And we see that human reason is at work. Verse 5, we've gotten rid of our labor force. What in the world were we thinking? What in the world are we doing? We've let them go away from us. We see that there's human strength. Verse 6, he takes his chariot, his special chariot. He gets ready his army. He takes 600 special chariots. And then every other available chariot, and he puts officers in charge of all of them. I mean, when you think of a battle strategy, this is a pretty good one. He says, I want my army tanks. I want my planes. I want my navy assembled. I want every resource available to me that's at my disposal. I want them activated, and I want them activated now. I want all my trained officers, I want all of my agents, I want all of my special forces, I want them to be deployed immediately. We're on our way. The best of human reason, the best of human strength. And we see in verse 9 that they gain human success. The Egyptians pursued them, all his horses, his chariots, his horsemen, his army, and they overtook them. In fact, they overtook them because they were camping. They caught him. Oh, you think? Of course he caught him. They were camping. They've got human success. But in the midst of this part of the scene, God gives us verse 8. All of this happened because the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, so that he pursued the people of Israel. Even while the people of Israel were going out defiantly, they were going out with a high hand. They were going out with the strong arm of God upon them. Only an idiot would chase a God who's decimated his nation. Guess what? It's exactly what happens. Okay? And from a human standpoint, the human reason, the human strength yields a human success. But we get to see the other side of the story. God's in control of all of this. There's the assurance of a divine attendance in the midst of this divine dilemma. God's watching. God's knowing. God's preparing. In fact, we're going to see that God is actually moving the events to make them happen. What an amazing God. Voice number one, the problem we face, it's a loud voice. Go get them. We're going to get them with the biggest force we can assemble. We're going to come out fast and furious. And they do. Well, that brings us just naturally to the next part of the story. Because voice number two is the people that we pilgrim with. In verses 10 through 14, we see that when Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians are marching after them, and they feared greatly. They trembled in their boots. Their knees were knocking together. Their teeth were chattering. They said, "The Egyptians are coming." In the midst of this, as they turn around, they look around. It says they lifted up their eyes, and behold, this is what they saw. This led only to fear. I wonder sometimes if the fear that we have in our lives isn't because the only thing that we're looking at is when we lift up our eyes, we look around us. You know what? Life looks pretty bad right now because of what I see on this level. Praise God, it doesn't stop there. The next verse, it says, and the people cried out, end of the verse, the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They looked out, and all they saw was bad. They looked up, but this led to nothing. There was no real expectation in this prayer. It affected no change in their lives. How do we know that? Because the next place that they look, verse 11, they look back. They looked around, they looked up, they cried out to the Lord, more a disgust than an asking and expecting for God to answer. Then verse 11, they turn to Moses, they say, what's up with this? Is it because there's no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? What is this that you have done? Moses, this is all your fault. If looking around at this level gives us a sense of fear and terrorizes and stops our progress forward, looking back is a quick way to fall into the trap of bitterness. Because as I look back and I look at all the choices that were made for me to get to this place in my life, it's pretty easy for me to start saying, you know what? Oh yeah. And then there was that choice back there. And then there was that person. You know, I wouldn't be in this position if it wasn't for that person who made this choice in my life. And as they look back, they become bitter. In fact, they get to that place where they say, it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. You ever been there? Man, what am I doing? This way that God led me. It seemed like it was so romantic to step out in faith, to march out into the wilderness, to leave behind my taskmasters, and I'm going where God is leading me, and of a sudden I'm blindsided by a rhinoceros. What's up with that? Okay. Do you ever get to that place where you want to say, let me just go back to what I already know? Was I living there? Not much of a life. I was pretty dead. I wasn't moving forward. I wasn't making any progress. But better to be living dead, because I'm not really dying to live this way. I'll be dead anyway if I keep on going. Stepping out in faith. What kind of an adventure is this? They looked around and they were afraid. They looked up. It led to nothing. They looked back. It led to bitterness and to anger. So Moses has to tell them, look forward. Look forward. Verse 13. Moses said to the people, don't be afraid. Oh, that's a good idea. I'm going to just like turn it off like that. Don't be afraid. Stand firm. As opposed to what? Running back to Egypt. Watch, see, observe the salvation of the Lord, which He will work for you today. The Egyptians that you're looking at, you'll never have to look at again. But I want you to look at something that's worth looking at. Don't just look around. And as you look up, I want you to see what you're supposed to see. I want you to see that God is actually going to work a work on your behalf, and He'll do it today. Verse 14, the Lord will fight for you. You have only to be silent. Again, Swindoll says when we get in this position, we do four things. First, we get afraid. Second, we run. Then when it finally catches us, we fight. And then number four, we talk. And we talk about it to everybody. God says, do the exact opposite. Don't be afraid. Don't run. You don't fight. I'll fight for you. And then just shut up. Just quiet. Whoa. Moses is telling the people at this minute, folks, breathe. You're uptight. Settle down. God's got everything under control. God's not unaware of your circumstances. God's not unaware of your security. God's not unaware of your welfare. And even if He was, there's something more important at stake in all of this than you. It's Him. It's His glory. You can bet that God's not going to fail. He's not going to fail you in your welfare, because it's all about Him and His glory. And your story is a part of God's story. Okay. Exodus builds on Genesis. If we don't get Genesis in place, if we don't get the beginning of the story, we lose the rest of the story. This story isn't primarily about me, it's about God. That's why the third voice in the story is God's, the God that we serve. So verse 15, the Lord said to Moses, what are you doing? Why are you crying to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. And He reveals His plan. Verse 16, we see God's plan for His people's salvation. Lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea, divide it. It's the word that means to split. Split the water. It's like when you bring the axe down on that piece of wood and it goes crunch, whoosh. Divide it. Split it. And then He says that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. Moses, here's my plan. I want them to go forward. I want them to be done camping. I want them to keep on with their pilgrimage. I want them to be done resting. Verse 17, the plan is revealed not only for the people's salvation, but for His enemies' destruction. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh, over his hosts, over his chariots, over his horsemen. He doesn't say exactly how just at this point, but he says, Moses, my salvation will bring both the salvation of my people and the destruction of my enemies. And verse 18 reminds us that all of this, again, is for God's own glory. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. Middle of verse 17, I will get glory over Pharaoh. I've gotten glory over Pharaoh, over his chariots, over his horsemen. Okay. The best that this world has to offer, the biggest, the scariest, the fastest, the loudest, God says, I want them to see that I'm bigger. I'm faster. I can take care of this. When their whole focus is on bringing you under, my whole purpose is lifting you up. What an awesome God. Now, you've got this divine dilemma, and voices are coming at you from every direction. You've got the voice of the problem. You got the voice of the people. What's wrong with you? How come you're not doing anything? You got the voice of God. And he's saying, shh. Now move forward. We come to the verse 19, and we see that the dilemma is now resolved as Moses moves forward into his divine deliverance. Verses 19 and 20, there's a presence that remains. That presence that we saw at the end of chapter 13, verse 19, the angel of God who was going before the host of Israel moved and went behind them. The pillar of cloud moved from before them, stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt, the host of Israel. There's a new position for God's presence. God's with his people. He had been leading them, led them to this place, and stopped. Now he says, Moses, I want you to go forward. And while you do that, the presence moves no longer before, but behind. And in being behind God's people, he separates the people of God from the enemies of God. Before, behind, so that he can be between. There's a new function now for this presence. It had been guiding them through the wilderness. Now it turns out that he's guarding them in the midst of the wilderness. Verse 20, it says, there was the cloud, the darkness. It lit up the night so that one could not come near the other all night. They didn't. Why? Because God's presence was with his people. The present remains. The plan is executed in verses 21 through 29. So, verse 21, Moses stretches out his hand. The Lord drives back the sea with a strong wind. He makes the sea dry land. The waters are divided. So, he does what he's supposed to do. Moses, I want you to lift up your hand. I want you to do your part. Moses does it. He goes out there. He lifts up the rod. He lifts up his hands. And then we see that the people walk through on dry ground. Verse 22, the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground. And understand how they're going. End of the verse. As they're going through there, the waters are a wall for them on their right hand and on their left hand. Several have said that there was a land bridge and the water was very shallow at that point. One old preacher was preaching this way and he didn't really believe it. The folks, he was preaching about how they crossed the Red Sea, and one guy in the audience says, praise the Lord, what a miracle! And the old preacher says, it was no miracle, there was just a land bridge, there wasn't much water there. He said, well, praise the Lord, what a miracle that he drowned an entire army with not much water. Okay. You can't get around the fact that this was a miracle. In fact, the walls that it says this water was walled up, It's the words for the city walls. These are Jericho walls. These are hold everybody out kind of walls. Okay? And this is what they're walking through. This takes no small amount of courage. Okay? This is like marching through the shark tank without glass. Okay. If you think about it, what's holding it back? Nothing. Nothing but God. That's faith. So Moses does his part. The children of Israel do their part, and guess what? God does his part. Did Moses push back the waters? Did the children of Israel push back the waters? Can't you just see some smart aleck junior high kid going, watch this. Get your cell phone out. They didn't do that, but God did. Verse 21, so the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night. In fact, he made that sea dry land. He made sure that those waters were cut in two. What an amazing God. You know, as we enter into this journey with God, there's a divine human cooperative. God won't do my part, and he doesn't expect me to do his part. But I've got a part to do. What part is that? Obedience and following. Okay. You share the gospel. You save people. No, I can't do that. You tell people about Jesus, and what will God do? He'll save people. What an awesome thing. Okay? You just follow. You do your part. And when you do your part, God can do his. God's people experience this salvation. God does his part. Verse 21, he controls and he moves nature. He literally moves nature. Moves the seas. In verse 23, he moves people. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea. Why did they do that? Is that a boneheaded move? Only because we know the end of the story. Okay? Why did they do it? Because God controls nature and God controls even people. And God hardened their hearts and moved them in because God was going to destroy them. And then that's exactly what happens. God's people experience God's salvation. God's enemies experience God's destruction. Verse 24, God looks down on the Egyptian forces. He throws them into a panic. He clogs their chariot wheels. And in verse 27, he shakes them off into the sea. This is a God who's inherently active in the midst of this divine dilemma. We come down to verse 26 and we see that God, in fact, receives the glory. In fact, end of verse 25, the Egyptians say, "Let's get out of here. God's fighting for Israel and he's fighting against us." Oh, wait a minute. Who is? Yahweh. Remember how this whole story starts? Chapter 5, verse 1. Yahweh says, "Let my people go." Pharaoh says, "Who's Yahweh?" Pharaoh had never heard of him, and guess what? Neither had the rest of the Egyptian forces. Now every soldier in his ranks understands who Yahweh is. That he fights for his people and he fights against the enemies of his people. It's exactly what God had promised to Abraham. All who bless you, I will bless. All who curse you, I will curse. He demonstrates complete control. Look at what it says there, verse 26. "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, upon their horsemen, upon this whole thing that they assembled." Verse 28, "The waters returned and covered the chariots, covered the horsemen, and all the hosts of Pharaoh that followed them into the sea, not one remained." God was in absolute control, accomplishing absolute destruction, so that verse 29, he could accomplish an absolute salvation. But the people of Israel, they walked through the sea on dry ground. The waters were a wall to them on their left and on their right. God was absolutely in control of all of this. Then we see in verses 30 and 31, as he concludes the story, that their pilgrimage continues. Their identity has been secured as a holy people. There's the people that God moves forward. There's the people that God holds back. There's the people that God brings salvation. There's the people that God brings destruction. Their identity as the people of God has been absolutely secured. There's no more Pharaoh. There's no more Egyptian army. There's no more voice number one. There's no threat. It's done. It's gone. Their identity is secured. Their past is secured. The Egyptians are dead. Now their future is secured. Look at verse 31. "So Israel saw the great power that the Lord had used against the Egyptians. So the people feared" who? Feared the Lord. The Lord who was for them or against them? He was for them. Here's the whole point. The fear of the Lord is understanding that God is the greater reality in my life. God is the greater reality in my life. Do you believe that? Oh, yeah, I believe that, yeah. Okay, sign me up. Okay, you passed the Christian exam. Way to go. Okay, but do you believe it down here? You know what? The rest of your life is is an adventure trying to believe this one thing, that God is the greater reality. If you really believe that, you'll really pass the test. Every time that test comes about. This adventure of a lifetime continues along fairly simple lines. Okay? There's a dilemma and there's a deliverance because God's glory at stake. But along the way, we need to learn to expect dilemmas. Okay? Don't be blindsided. Peter says, don't think it's some strange affliction you're falling into. Paul says, everyone who's godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer divine dilemmas, persecution. Okay? Expect it. Paul, when he's preaching to the churches, he says, only through much tribulation do we enter into the kingdom of God. It's a pilgrimage. And along the way, before you get to the promised land, expect dilemmas. Number two, make sure you're listening to the right voice. You're going to get it in your ear from every direction. But in the midst of it, you've got to go to the voice that matters most. Because God isn't going to be silent in the midst of your suffering. He speaks, and He speaks truth. Number three, just do your part. What's your part? Just take that next step. Okay, God, there's a whole sea I got to cross. How am I going to do that? One step at a time. One step at a time. And as you step out, guess what? That ground was dry. Guess what? That ground was dry. One step at a time. Number four, wait and watch for that divine deliverance. Because God orchestrates everything in your life so that He can reveal His glory. Do you believe that? Every problem He brings into you, everything that goes wrong, God brings into your life so that He can make it right. Everything. Number five, learn all you can about your God, because this life is about the greater reality, that is God. Let's pray.